Today on the 21st Show, it's been just over 5 years since the COVID closures began. For many, 2020 is a year they'd rather forget. But the pandemic and its many disruptions are still casting long shadows over American life.
These bedrocks of my life, the foundational things that keep us all up, were suddenly gone.
Today, we're revisiting our conversation with author and sociologist Eric Kleinenberg. His book, out now in paperback, is 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in Rockford DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Annual COVID shots, occasional COVID surges, staying home from work, maybe digging out a mask every now and then. These have become familiar patterns since 2020. But think back to those frightening early days of the pandemic, before the vaccine, and when we were told to stand 6 feet apart wearing a mask, or better yet, just stay at home. In some ways, it seems like forever ago, a time many would rather forget. And yet we are still living in a world and a country reshaped by that era. So today we're revisiting our conversation with Eric Kleinenberg, a sociologist and professor at New York University. In his latest book, he says the story of the pandemic, our shared and individual experiences, have more expansive consequences than we have collectively acknowledged. Today, Kleinenberg writes, across the planet, people inhabit their world differently than they did before the plague hit. But what changed, where, and how is not yet fully apparent. He says, most of us have been busy trying to get through the crisis. We've lacked the time and space to consider what we have lived through, or to ask why things turned out the way they did. For many, thinking back about what happened in that fateful year feels overwhelming. Our private conversations, and our public ones too, have been shaped by what sociologists call the will not to know. Well, today, we are going to will ourselves to know, to answer some of the questions Kleinenberg says we would do well to consider. Questions like, why face masks were so divisive in some places and relatively uncontroversial in others? Why were some neighborhoods more vulnerable? How did class and race factor into the pandemic? And how did some countries actually improve trust in government and science, while others saw it erode? Eric Kleinenberg's book is 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. It recently came out in paperback. We spoke with Kleinenberg last year in April, and I started by asking him when he decided to begin researching for the book.
Yeah, well, this is an area that I've done work in for my career. I'm a sociologist. I'm interested in crises. The kind of theory of my work has always been that crises reveal things. If we look closely at what happens when societies are under stress, we can see who we are, what we value, whose lives matter. And so I'm always on the lookout for situations that seem like they're going to open up opportunities to learn about ourselves. And I was teaching a course at NYU at the time on the sociology of climate change. And one of the problems I was teaching has to do with what psychologists sometimes call the paradox of cognition. The idea is that we're kind of set up psychologically to deal with urgent threats that are right in front of us. And so we get activated and want to do something when there's something immediate, but there are big problems that are looming in the background, and we know they're significant, but we have trouble mustering the energy to engage them because they're distant. And climate is the classic one there. It's hard to do stuff about global warming because it always feels like something today matters more. And I was talking about it, looking for an example, and I said in late January, early February, for instance, who in my classroom is concerned about this new virus that they're talking about in China? And basically nobody raised their hand. The students looked at me like I was an insane person, except for one student who had just come to New York University from China. And what happened is over the course of several weeks, I kept asking the question, until not only was everyone raising their hand right away, but they shut the whole university down.
Yeah, we were talking about this among the producers I work with on this program this morning. One person mentioned when Tom Hanks and his spouse, Rita Wilson, were diagnosed. That was in early March. Somebody else said when the NBA shut down. Personally, I had a friend who was very concerned in early February, and I thought they were just being a worry wart. But then there was a particular interview I heard late February that made me, it was actually on the NPR program On the Media with Lori Garrett, the journalist of health and science, that sort of woke me up for it. When did you get the sense this is not going to be a regional story out of China anymore?
Well, I have a friend who is a medical doctor, and she was at a public health conference in Washington, D.C. in February. And she came back and told me, you know, this one's going to be pretty serious. And I remember telling my wife at the time, like, next time we drive out of Manhattan and find ourselves in a place with big box stores, we should really stock up on a few things. And we're not exactly preppers, but, you know, we did go out and get a bunch of stuff. Thank goodness, because it turns out, you know, as we all remember, by March, it was hard to get things like cleaning supplies and toilet paper. But then, you know, it really didn't fully hit home, Brian, until I was coming back from a trip to Cleveland, Ohio. I'd written a book that what they'd selected as the kind of book that everybody in the city was going to read. And there was a big event at the theater downtown that I've been looking forward to for a long time. And I was unsure that I would take the trip because we already had some COVID in New York. But the organizers kept saying, oh, well, there's nothing in Cleveland, you know, you should come. So I went. Turned out I got to Cleveland the morning that Ohio had its first three cases. The stock market crashed and everything started to shut down there. But it hit home fully when I came home the next morning, because when I arrived, I learned that my son, who was 13 at the time, and, you know, big soccer player with an incredible engine, and kid just never gets tired. He was feverish. He was exhausted. His muscles were aching. He couldn't get off the couch, and it seemed a lot like this new disease, COVID, everyone was talking about. And the problem was, since I lived in the United States of America, there was no way to know. We didn't have tests, and I sure didn't want to take him to the hospital at the time. So suddenly this thing that we were reading about became incredibly personal for me, and it would become the thing that overtook my life and everyone else's life in the next several months.
So you mentioned your son being sick. What were the first months of the pandemic like for you then?
Well, I mean, the first thing is that I have two kids, and they were 13 and 10 at the time. And the pandemic meant that, you know, suddenly they were not in school, they were home. And I was teaching at NYU, and NYU was suddenly doing this thing called remote education, which seemed really weird at the time, but now, of course, is a staple of our lives. So, you know, my wife and I had to turn ourselves into, you know, newly skilled workers who could do everything through a computer. And we also had to work in our university jobs as we were parenting and cooking and trying to, you know, give our kids something to do that would allow them not to bounce off the walls. And, you know, suddenly it was like our world got very, very narrow. And, you know, I'm from Chicago originally. Most of my family's in Illinois. And I started to worry a lot about my parents. Didn't know if they were going to get sick and what would happen to them. I mean, the feeling in 2020 in March and April was like it felt like the floor had fallen out from beneath us, like the ground had given way, and suddenly we were just tumbling. I worried about my family's health. I worried about my son. It was a week before he recovered, and that was a terrifying time. I didn't know if my job would be there. I'm a tenured professor, but I kept thinking, like, who's going to want to come to study in New York City while New York is the epicenter of this pandemic? And worried about economic security, all that stuff. So suddenly life felt very precarious in a way that I can't recall it feeling before. That's a privilege. Other people feel that precarity far more often, and I'm aware of that. But there's this phrase that sociologists sometimes use that is, you know, comes from Marx. It's all that was solid melted into air. And it felt at that time like these bedrocks of my life. The foundational things that keep us all up were suddenly gone. And it's at that moment that I realized, and I'm not going to just live this. I'm actually going to start to really study and try to understand what we're living through, because I think it's going to matter.
Let me remind listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with Eric Kleinenberg, a sociologist at New York University and the author of 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year That Changed Everything. You write about how we need virologists to understand the sort of mechanisms of SARS-CoV-2, the virus itself. You know, we need economists to understand why certain government responses are more effective than others. Why do we need a social autopsy of the pandemic?
Well, because so much of what happened to us is not about the virus itself, but about our collective response to it. And of course, we know that because nations had very different experiences in 2020, based on their values, based on their policies, based on their behavior. Cities had different experiences. Neighborhoods had different experiences. So it's really the social world that mediated the impact of the virus. And, you know, I write about that just in the very beginning of the pandemic. The book opens with this comparison between what happened when two cruise ships, the Grand Princess and the Diamond Princess, both obviously owned by the same company, Princess Cruise Lines, when they left port. The Diamond Princess was in Tokyo. It left Japan. And when they had some cases of COVID that came on, Japan welcomed the ship back into its harbor. It didn't need to do that legally, but it did. It sent a bunch of scientists on board to try to figure out, you know, what is this disease? How does it spread? They figured out that there could be asymptomatic carriers. They figured out that air circulation issues really mattered and air filtration was important. They're trying to figure out how they could prevent the spread. They quarantined people. They brought people slowly back onto land when they were ready to be cleared or treated if they needed to be hospitalized. It was this kind of very educational experience that wound up framing and shaping a lot of the Japanese social policy. They made some mistakes in the quarantines. They didn't handle the situation perfectly, but they're very careful about it, and very evidence driven in their response. And as many listeners will know, Japan wound up having one of the most effective responses to COVID that year. And what happened when the Grand Princess left the United States could not be more different. It left San Francisco, and when passengers started to get sick, this is just a few weeks later, they wanted to return. The president of the United States at the time said famously that he did not want to allow the ship back. He did not want even Americans coming back onto land. And he said that was because he liked the COVID numbers where they were. He didn't want the numbers to change. And then finally, after a lot of debate, it became clear that there wasn't really a plan for what to do with the passengers or with the COVID more generally. Eventually, the U.S. let the ship back onto land, but they refused to let it go back to San Francisco. They sent it back to Oakland into the ports. And that's meaningful if you know anything about race and class in America. It's a Black and more poor city. And then when Americans came off the ship, instead of having it be orderly, instead of getting careful medical attention, doing scientific research, it was a chaotic process in which people were shipped all over the place. And eventually, when the government tried to detain people, to quarantine them, to test them for COVID, lots of Americans refused all of that and said that they had the right to do what they wanted to do. They fled the scene, and they later wound up suing the government. And of course, that was just a sign of what a chaotic and dysfunctional response the United States would have to this situation. And I think one thing for us to know is 2020 in many parts of the world was far more controlled, far less devastating, far less deadly, far less divisive than it proved to be in the United States. And so you need a social autopsy to understand that.
I'm so glad you brought in the cruise ship examples, because I had completely forgotten about those until I was reading about it in your book. I guess I vaguely remembered it, but certainly not the details. You can really see the seeds of institutional distrust and scientific skepticism in the way a lot of people responded to that, right, when they were brought back on shore.
So early, and your response of not remembering, it's kind of the point of the book. So much happened to us so quickly with such grave consequences that it was, I think, impossible for any of us as human beings to really take it all in. Because, of course, 2020 wasn't just about the virus and the pandemic. Suddenly, millions of people lost their jobs, right? The markets crashed. People left cities. The police murdered George Floyd. There were historic civil rights demonstrations. The Black Lives Matter movement transformed the way that we dealt with issues around racial inequality, at least for a time. There was an assault on the democratic process and democratic institutions in this election year. I mean, it was an overwhelming time to be alive. And so I didn't know that all that stuff would happen, but I really did have a sense that it's important for me in real time to try to capture as much of what's happening in this year as I can. I was able to hire a staff of doctoral students from the university and eventually a postdoctoral researcher. And we kind of fanned out and just started, you know, covering whatever we could to track the social life of this year. And I do have to say one thing. And I noticed when you talked about the subtitle of the book, you said, "The year that changed everything." Actually, the subtitle, the book is 2020, one
the
city,
year that everything
seven
changed.
People.
I misread it, didn't I? Yeah.
The year everything changed. I'm really pointing it out because it raised this question. Everything changed in 2020. It's hard to think of a time when our day-to-day lives changed more, when we engaged each other differently. But did it change everything? I mean, I think that's a debate.
Let me reintroduce the program. We're listening back to my conversation with Eric Kleinenberg, author of 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. Coming up after the break, we'll talk with Eric about how the U.S. compares to the rest of the world when it comes to how they addressed the COVID-19 pandemic and why we were so uniquely dysfunctional. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today, we're revisiting a conversation from last April with guest Eric Kleinenberg. He's the Helen Gould Shepherd Professor of Social Science at New York University and the director of NYU's Institute for Public Knowledge. His previous books include Palaces for the People, Going Solo, and Heat Wave, about why more than 700 Chicagoans died from heat in July 1995. His latest book, recently out in paperback, is 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. It's about not only the first year of the pandemic, but how the consequences of that time are still shaping our lives. Kleinenberg writes, "The threats of 2020 would do considerably more damage and induce far more sweeping changes than anyone anticipated. The coronavirus, we now know, was only the primary cause. The deeper threat came from us." Let's get back to our conversation with Kleinenberg, which, again, we first aired about a year ago. We pick up by asking him about some of the individual stories in the book, including that of May Lee, a school principal, and how he came to know her.
Well, the strategy for the book was at first that I was going to tell a global story and have characters from different parts of the world. But of course, COVID meant that we couldn't really travel around the world. And so I realized I can't be in the world. At least I'm in New York and the world is in New York. And I decided I was going to profile one person from every borough. So five boroughs of New York. Plus I wound up trying to think of what I had missed. And I'd missed the story of someone who died very early in the pandemic. That's the sixth person. And I missed the story of someone for whom the year was mainly about the Black Lives Matter protests and civil rights demonstrations, and that's the seventh. The first character is May Lee, and May is a principal at a elementary school on the Lower East Side in Chinatown of Manhattan. She's the principal of a school she went to as a kid, and she's deeply tied to the neighborhood. Her story's first in part because the story of what happened in schools and to school communities is so important, but also because she, as a Chinese American, was learning from her community of students also primarily Chinese American, that this COVID thing was real, that it was serious. And in January and February, the families in her school were already masking up. They were pulling kids from school. People weren't going to work. They started to respond. And, you know, the thing that was really worrisome for her at first is that, you know, again, the previous president of the country couldn't resist the temptation to start talking about, you know, what he called the China virus or Kung Flu. The World Health Organization kept warning political officials not to try to turn this into an ethnic issue, not to stir up anger and prejudice. But President Trump leaned into all of that. And she started getting harassed herself on the streets of Chinatown. She got worried that her students were going to get harassed, and she had to figure out how to protect them. And then once the schools got closed, she had to figure out not just how to protect people, but how to make sure that they could keep on getting educated. And this is a very poor community. Kids who live often in multifamily apartment dwellings, they're crowded even during normal times. And now suddenly no one's going to work or school. They didn't necessarily have Wi-Fi connections. They didn't necessarily have laptop computers. The city tried to distribute tablets, and you know, they didn't have doormen or addresses where you could just leave tablets out. And no one was answering their doors. So she had her entire family working with her to try to call each family in the school and hand deliver these things. And then she also realized that school's not just a place for education. It's also a place where people get their meals. And she had to fight the Department of Education to get the kitchen going again so that they could give out meals to families that needed them. And I think you see in May's story the kind of amazing efforts that it took to preserve a school community and to keep people above water when it felt like everything was going to drown. And I think you also see in this early story the way in which this health event became a racial event and got organized around patterns of discrimination and prejudice and even violence in ways that I think are really worth remembering. Unfortunately, that anti-Asian sentiment and the spike in hate crimes that started in 2020 has stayed pretty high in this country since.
And in that story, especially of the initial response you just described there, her fighting with the bureaucracy over things like school lunches, the fact that her families in her school were coming to her with early knowledge because they're connected to people on WeChat all over the world much earlier than the official New York City government had come up with a plan for what to do about this. How does America's initial response to the pandemic contrast with some of our peer countries? And I suppose by that, I mean wealthy democracies.
Yeah, the chapter right after May is kind of tries to deal with that question. The structure of the book is that I alternate between the kind of profiles of these characters and chapters that try to take on these puzzles, like how did the American response differ, the initial response? And in the chapter, I compare the US to England and also to Australia, because they're countries that have a lot like us, that are a lot like us. At the time, all three countries had conservative leaders. They all had relatively strong commitment to individualism and to letting the market do its thing. Welfare states that work similarly. You might recall that in 2019, 2020, there were these historic bushfires in Australia. And the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, refused to say that they had anything to do with climate change. He's a climate change and science skeptic. Australia was going through a big crisis of polarization. Distrust was high. The country was very divided and contentious. And, you know, it could have looked to an observer from the outside that Australia and the US, let's take those two, would go down similar paths. What happened in the US, you might recall, is President Trump used this kind of magical thinking, the virus is going to go away by Easter, it just kind of disappears, and we're doing a perfect job, and I'd like the numbers where they are, all that stuff that really precluded the country from responding quickly and aggressively, even though, by the way, outside observers and health experts had ranked the U.S. the most prepared country in the world for a pandemic before 2020, but we couldn't execute that plan. But in Australia, what Scott Morrison did is he convened the leaders of every state and territory in Australia, not just the political officials, but also the health ministers. They had a special set of regular meetings, and they just did a kind of very reasonable thing, what you would expect any government, regardless of their political party, before 2020 to do. They got the best knowledge they had, and they made a plan. They subsidized the production and distribution of masks. They developed systems for testing and also tracing. They closed the borders. They closed schools. They put in quarantines when necessary. And, you know, it's a federal government like the US, so they had some national guidelines and then local variations. And what happened in Australia over 2020 after this initial response is it wound up, you know, not only being incredibly safe in terms of public health. And by the way, if the US had the same death rate from COVID as Australia, about 900,000 Americans would still be alive today, which is just a stunning number for me. But also, and I think this is really crucial, by the end of 2020, levels of trust in other people, in science, and in the government had gone up in Australia, whereas in the United States, trust was plummeting. And you know, in my book, I do talk about death and disease, of course, but I'm also really interested in what happened to trust in America, what happened to our faith in government, what happened to our attitudes about science and medication and vaccines, because there's a bigger story here than a story of public health. There's also a really big story to tell about what 20 did to our body politic and our public life. And I think it goes a long way to explain why things are so off today and why there's so much brutal division in this country.
Well, let's talk about that. And you can't get into this story without mentioning former President Trump, as you do there. You also single out, there are some, this is not necessarily all on the right, right? California Governor Gavin Newsom did his own share of damage to public trust, as did other government officials, making some questions.
Governor Cuomo.
Yeah, exactly.
Who was a hero for a lot of Americans on national TV, but who kept being very dishonest about what was happening in the nursing homes in New York, trying to fudge the numbers and make it look like it wasn't as bad as it was.
So what was America predestined for this because of the polarization that has become so prominent here to have this outcome of the pandemic, do you think? Or did something happen specifically that year that made it worse?
Well, you would say that we are predestined because, you know, when sociologists and anthropologists compare the kind of cultural values and practices of people in the US with people in other countries, we often, you know, show up on the more individualistic side, whereas, you know, countries like, say, South Korea or Japan show up more on the collectivist side. But the problem with that argument is we have places like Australia or New Zealand that are also very high on individualism, that also were dealing with polarization and distrust, and where leaders were able to mobilize and just be kind of ordinarily sane and reasonable, trying to find the best minds and letting their policy be driven by, you know, what the best public health was telling them to do. Now, you know, in the book, I'm pretty clear about the fact that the science around these situations is complicated. And of course, public health involves balancing different kinds of concerns, right? So you can for sure reduce the spread of a disease by closing everything and making everyone stay in their homes, but that does come at a cost, and that cost can also be, you know, painful and dangerous, right? It can hurt the economy, it can damage our mental health, it can put people in really precarious situations. So the question about the science is like, what are you trying to optimize? What's your value? But in the US, the problem was it was just chaos. It was dysfunctional. And I don't write all that much about President Trump in the book because that story has been told. And I found myself, you know, kind of not wanting to go too deep on it. But But I don't let him out of the book either, because you can't understand, I think, why the U.S. was so uniquely dysfunctional and why our policies were so deranged, and why we got so angry at each other, if you don't understand the way that President Trump pumped out misinformation and magical thinking and used the crisis as kind of a wedge issue to pit his people against other people, rather than doing what, you know, people like Scott Morrison in Australia did, and most other leaders, not all, which is to try to unify their society to have a common collective response. And that's not a thing that only Democrats or Republicans could do. That's not necessarily partisan. But what we were not able to do because of our leadership was do anything that involves unifying a divided country. And we needed that.
We need to take a break in a few more minutes, but before we do, I don't think we'll have time to get into the full story, but one of your other people you profile is Daniel Presti, if I'm saying that right. He's a Staten Island bar owner who really becomes radicalized by the sort of stay home orders, the business closure orders, sets up what he calls an autonomous zone, goes from somebody who was fairly apolitical, self-described at least, at the beginning of the pandemic, to somebody who by the end of the year is arrested and accused of attempting to run over a sheriff's deputy in his car, although the story's a little more complicated than that, as we learn. I guess I want to get to the idea of this division that comes up. Is there a counterfactual you can imagine where things might have gone differently, right? The president embraces masks. People on the right, see it as a totem of their tribal affiliation, you know, a celebration of outlaws, or people who, you know, the people who like to dress up like they're waiting for the call from SEAL Team 6. I wonder if you have ever thought about, you know, this idea that things could have gone in the other way, and maybe our political polarization might have flipped our pandemic response here.
Well, it easily could have gone the first way. I mean, I think there are a lot of, you know, right-wing leaders around the world who did use the event as an occasion to try to unify people around, you know, shared values and promote themselves and give themselves more power. Like one could imagine President Trump manufacturing, you know, tens of millions of masks that said Trump on them, right? You could imagine him calling the two vaccines Ivana and Ivanka. I mean, he could have seized this moment as a, you know, kind of like militaristic campaign to unify Americans in a shared fight against this common enemy. And it, you know, could have been the virus. There are all kinds of things he could have done. And I don't think his response was necessarily partisan. It became very partisan, but I think the what drove his response was just the chaos in his mind, the totally undisciplined approach, the randomness that got him recommending, you know, that Americans inject Clorox, or on one day, or maybe on some days he took pride in Operation Warp Speed, which was, you know, perhaps the great success of the White House during that year, like helping vaccines get to market and clear regulatory hurdles and get available.
So his audience boos him for that. Yes.
Yeah, because and on other days he then refuses to advocate for it and is wishy-washy on whether it helps. So there's just I do think about the counterfactual you raised, because I think, unfortunately, the chaos of the president's mind and the chaos in the president's administration, the wanting to have things both ways and really having no way or direction at all, was uniquely destructive for the United States. I don't think George Bush or George W. Bush or Bill Clinton or Barack Obama would have done anything like what President Trump did in this country. I think if it had any of them been president, we would have had a very different experience.
Let me reintroduce the program. We're listening back to my conversation with Eric Kleinenberg, author of 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. We first broadcast this in April last year. We need to take a break, but before that, I also want to mention that tomorrow on the program, we'll be talking about President Donald Trump's tariffs. How do you expect them to affect you? Or maybe you don't. Will these tariffs help or hurt the economy? And what do you think of the president's performance so far on economic issues? Talk at 21stshow.org is our email address. Talk at 21stshow.org. More to come on the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today we're revisiting our conversation with Eric Kleinenberg. His latest book is 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. We spoke with him last year in April. The book is recently out in paperback. Kleinenberg is a sociologist and a professor at New York University. We spoke about how, as the title suggests, 2020 changed everything, and how we as Americans have failed to reckon with those changes, to give them their due weight. Because today's program is on tape, we're not taking calls, but we did when we first went to air, so we'll pick back up with a question from Paul in Urbana.
Thank you. I appreciate this kind of personalist focus and all, but and I think you might be sympathetic to a more structural problem. The U.S. medical system is in a way designed to keep prices high. And there's a great journalist at American Prospect, Dave Dian, who at the time did the study on ventilators. And there was actually a company that had a contract with the backup supply system. I forget the name of it, to produce these. But there was a what's called a destructive acquisition. A company that made most of the ventilators in this country acquired it and didn't fulfill the contract. And I don't know how well other countries were supplied on ventilators, but we were certainly short. And I see this as a structural problem. Mobile X-ray units were used widely through Asia to do a really early diagnostic, and those are not very available in this country either. And I just think of it a broader structural look at this is a failure of the American medical non-system. And I'd like for you to respond to some of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate the call. Eric, how about that? I mean, I guess that's a big part of this book and that article I referenced in the New York Times is that we really haven't had that sort of systemic look at the pandemic.
Yeah, and I just want to make sure, Paul, and your listeners know, as a card-carrying member of the American Sociological Association, I make my living talking about structural. So I'm happy to go there as well. There are seven people in the book, and the profiles do help, I think, us to process a lot of the personal things we went through. But every other chapter tries to take on one of these structural questions. So you mentioned the issues about the health system and the health market. That was obviously really important. The thing that's most immediately significant in this story about ventilators and all kinds of other hospital equipment, you'll probably remember that there's a market for it, but it's also kind of funneled through the government. And the person who was put in charge of helping states procure essential medical supplies, you'll remember in dealing with supply chain issues, was Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. And what he did is he tried to amplify the market-based part of this rather than the kind of social distribution side of it. And he had the states competing against each other to try to buy essential medical equipment, which was driving up the prices even further. So at a moment where what you needed was kind of strong leadership and fair, equitable distribution coming from state policies, what you got instead was a kind of jacked up, hyper-competitive capitalist marketplace for the things that we needed to stay alive. And it was, of course, terribly destructive. The other really, issue that's structural that I write about on healthcare has to do with nursing homes. American nursing homes were much more dangerous than nursing homes in other societies, largely because it's also a for-profit marketplace for the most part. Workers in nursing homes typically are contingent workers. They don't make enough money to just work in one place. They often have several jobs. They work from nursing home to nursing home in different care facilities. And the facilities, which are owned by companies that are trying to maximize their profits, are nowhere nearly as high quality as they should be. There's report after report about the dangerous conditions in nursing homes in America on a daily basis, crowding, unsanitary conditions, all that kind of stuff. And now you combine crowding in nursing home facilities with contingent laborers who are going from facility to facility during the crisis, carrying the disease with them, and you have a formula for disaster. And so that's another big structural reason why so many older Americans died and why countries that do a better job with long-term care and dealing with aging as a social issue fared better than we did. So thank you for that great question.
Is the pandemic over? And if so, when did it end?
Well, I mean, yes and no. You know, as an official matter, because, you know, pandemic is a category and a concept that we give to public health situations through international health agencies and governments. It has been declared over. Is there still enormous amounts of COVID? Yes, without a doubt. And a lot of people who have underlying medical conditions or are precarious in other ways are concerned that the Biden administration and societies around the world have just kind of normalized a world in which this disease is rampant. And I think what's happening is it's in the process of becoming endemic. It's going to be a thing that we live with. Fortunately, in the general population, it is far less lethal than it was at first. We have vaccines, and the vaccines are very effective. We are better at treating it than we were. But COVID remains a really serious health issue, and enormous numbers of people around the world continue to die from COVID. We have in some ways normalized it. And I think there are a lot of people who are concerned that President Biden and his, you know, urge to kind of get things back to normal has overlooked how serious an issue it is for people. Of course, the problem is that, pandemic measures, mandatory mask use, closing institutions, things like that are extremely unpopular. And so the Democrats have not wanted to do that. But the real concern is we've kind of taken our foot off the gas when it comes to investing in public health, making sure that people get the care that they need, making sure that vaccines and medications are free and easily accessible for everyone, and making sure that we're continuing to really promote vaccination campaigns and epidemiological surveillance, which we need. And, you know, as the book winds down, I write about my concern that unlike other countries that experience things like SARS or MERS or, you know, recent, you know, major epidemics, the American response to the COVID has been this will not to know and kind of a will to divest. We've actually delegitimated public health. We have a campaign to defund public health. We're in some ways worse off, less prepared for the next pandemic in 2024 than we were at the beginning of 2020. And that for me is a terrifying thought.
Yeah, when we were the best prepared country, and how did we do? You know, I'm glad you're bringing this full circle. And we began by talking about, I think in the book, it's called The Tragedy of Cognition. I think you might refer to it as the paradox of cognition, this idea that, you know, we think of threats, distant threats. We have a hard time thinking about it. You know, global warming is the classic example. We may end up in a Mad Max movie or a Cormac McCarthy novel, but it's so far off. We don't really see it as something we need to deal with now. What are some examples? You mentioned some of the ways some of the countries dealt with these MERS and the SARS one. What are some examples of people in societies that have overcome the tragedy of cognition?
Well, I mean, I'm going to start very local because it's important for me to tell you that some of the characters in the book, like Mei Li, did just really extraordinary things to organize their communities at the neighborhood level so that they're better prepared for dealing with the many different kinds of crises that Americans face these days. The place where it really comes up is the chapter about a woman named Nuala O'Doherty. And it's a story of the rise of mutual aid networks, which is one great thing that happened in 2020. Americans, you know, we have this hyper-individualism that's part of our cultural heritage, but we also have this kind of civic engagement and tendency to volunteer and help each other out. And across the country, people did that in an incredible way. Nuala lives in Jackson Heights, Queens, which might be the most diverse neighborhood on the planet. There's something like 160 languages spoken there. She's from a family of Irish immigrants. She's married to an Ecuadorian guy, and they raise their kids in a house. And when the pandemic started, she realized that Jackson Heights was going to get really badly hit. And she put up some posters with her kids saying, you know, if you need help, call me. And she put her phone number on it. And within a day or two, hundreds of people had called her. And she was overwhelmed. So she made another poster, which her kids distributed, that said, if you can give help, call me. And before long, she had put together this mutual aid network. She called it the COVID Care Neighborhood Network. And enormous numbers of people wound up working with people in their community to share, to give services, to care, to, you know, procure diapers and food and medications, to help people sign up for vaccinations, to push for an open street that could function like a park in this green desert, this very urban neighborhood. And it's an amazing story. And what's incredible is that when I reached out to her recently to find out what's going on with her, to get an update, she told me that she is now using the same basement that was the base for COVID Care Neighborhood Network as the home of the Jackson Heights Immigration Center. And she and the same people who are working together back in 2020 are now, you know, helping asylum seekers in New York get situated, apply for citizenship, and try to get their lives together here. So I think what's important to note is that there is a world of people who at the local level are re-engaging civic life and trying to strengthen their social networks and their support systems so that no matter what the next threat is, no matter what the next problem is, they can handle it. And in my ideal world, the state would be supporting those efforts. Our governments would be helping to fund them and to give them a place to plug in so they could get the resources they need to work well. This is not the kind of mutual aid networks, you know, they need strong public programs too. And maybe we're going to get to that point.
You know, just a few minutes left in our time together, really probably a minute or two. I was thinking about the comparisons to September 11th. I recently, actually just last week, we visited New York, our family on vacation, and, you know, going through the airport, I'm still, you know, we're taking off our belts, we're taking off our shoes and jackets, we're being more thoroughly searched. There's the 9/11 memorial in Lower Manhattan. How in 2043, Eric, do you think we will or will not be reckoning with what happened in 2020?
I mean, it's such a great question. And it really is one of the questions that made me want to write the book and spark these conversations. You know, my fear now is that what's happened is the year 2020 has divided us more than it has united us. It has discouraged investment in public health programs more than it has encouraged it. It has made vaccines more controversial, not just for COVID, by the way, but for all kinds of diseases and health conditions that we were on the verge of, you know, getting rid of or had gotten rid of. I was in Florida a few weeks ago, and there was a measles outbreak because families are not getting their kids vaccinated. So there are a lot of trends that are going in the wrong direction. I think that I've argued that long COVID is not just a medical problem, it's also a social condition. And the kind of distrust and division and anger that we all felt in 2020 has gotten locked into our system. And so there is a story we could tell in which, you know, we keep separating and things keep falling in that direction. I guess it's my hope that if we do reckon with this crisis today, if we do face up to what we experienced in 2020, and if we can find the common ground where we all felt, you know, not necessarily lonely, but really kind of on our own to solve the problems, which was really the American condition across the partisan divide, this feeling of being on our own and having to really come up with our own solution. If we can bond around that and start to talk about what a good society would do mm-hmm. in the face of a crisis and what we owe each other, what we want to give each other, how, you know, how we could support each other through these situations, and COVID will not be the last one, then I think we have an opportunity to do something. But this is the real answer to your question is, it depends on what we do today.
It depends on what we do today. And we're going to have to leave it there. Eric Kleinenberg's book is 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. It's recently out in paperback. Kleinenberg is the Helen Gould Shepherd Professor in the Social Sciences and Director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. We spoke with him last year. That's it for us today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.